From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Since posting a 250,000 diplomatic cables last weekend, WikiLeaks has struggled to stay online. It's been taken down intermittently by denial-of-service attacks, which a hacker called The Jester has taken credit for. On Thursday, Amazon.com removed the website from its servers, denying it was pressured by the government to do so, explaining that WikiLeaks had violated its terms of service. As of Friday, the website was back up at wikileaks.ch, hosted by an information freedom group called the Swiss Pirate Party. But if the past week is any indicator, there's no telling where the website will be by the time you hear this. Meanwhile, the highlights of the latest document dump, orchestrated by WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange, which have appeared in Britain's Guardian newspaper, France's Le Monde, Germany's Der Spiegel, Spain's El País, and the New York Times, have enraged such legislators as Joe Lieberman, Lindsey Graham, and Peter King.
He's a menace, and he's, in my opinion, he's risked lives.
Well, I agree with the Pentagon's assessment that the people at WikiLeaks could have blood on their hands.
I have call on the Attorney General Eric Holder to immediately begin prosecution of WikiLeaks for violating the Espionage Act.
On Thursday, Senators John Ensign, Scott Brown, and Joe Lieberman introduced the so-called SHIELD Act to expand the World War I-era Espionage Act. Currently, it protects signal and satellite intelligence and cryptography. The SHIELD Act would cover human intelligence as well. Senator Ensign said in a statement, quote, "Our sources are bravely risking their lives when they stand up against the tyranny of Al-Qaeda, the Taliban, and murderous regimes, and I simply will not stand idly by as they become death targets because of Julian Assange." Some say the cables, which offer everything from snarky assessments of foreign leaders by U.S. diplomats to secret negotiations among heads of state in regional hotspots, are a game changer. Others say not so much.
The fact is, governments deal with the United States because it's in their interest, not because they like us, not because they trust us, and not because they believe we can keep secrets.
U.S. Defense Secretary Robert Gates.
Some governments deal with us because they fear us. Some because they respect us, most because they need us. So other nations will continue to deal with us. Is this embarrassing? Yes. Is it awkward? Yes. Consequences for U.S. foreign policy? I think fairly modest.
In fact, Kim Philby, who spied for the Soviets during the hottest period of the Cold War, observed in his 1968 book, My Silent War, that secret documents, though glamorous, are frequently a snare and a delusion. Quote, "Is it a first draft, a second draft, or the finished memorandum? Was it written by an official of standing or some dog's body with a bright idea? Even if it is a direct instruction to the U.S. ambassador from the Secretary of State dated last Tuesday, is it still valid today? In short, documentary intelligence, to be really valuable, must come at a steady stream embellished with an awful lot of explanatory annotation." Philby concluded, "An hour's serious discussion with a trustworthy informant is often more valuable than any number of original documents." In response to the developments of Wednesday and Thursday, WikiLeaks tweeted a link to a video posted on YouTube of excerpts from a speech by President John F. Kennedy in 1961 decrying government secrecy.
"We decided long ago that the dangers of excessive and unwarranted concealment of pertinent facts far outweighed the dangers which are cited to justify it."
But in that same speech, Kennedy made this request.
"But I do ask every publisher, every editor, and every newsman in the nation to re-examine his own standards and to recognize the nature of our country's peril. In time of war, the government and the press have customarily joined in an effort based largely on self-discipline to prevent unauthorized disclosures to the enemy."
New York Times executive editor Bill Keller has been quite open about standards his paper applies when deliberating whether to publish this sort of material. And the paper has reported on many of the latest revelations, some seemingly sensitive, some confirming conventional wisdom, and some simply WikiLicious. The paper obtained the cables from the British Guardian, not from WikiLeaks itself, as the Times had for previous document dumps. For reasons not entirely known but easy to guess at, including the Times' critical reporting of WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange and the Times' failure to link to the WikiLeaks website after the last document dump, relationships between the paper and WikiLeaks may be estranged for good. Bill Keller, welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
Now, the stories so far have been revealing, but unsurprising, it seems to me, and not especially indicting. Mm-hmm. It's made me wonder whether WikiLeaks is a legitimate whistleblower in this case or just a looter. Has Julian Assange shed light here with the release of 253,000 cables, or has he just smashed a very big store window?
I think the documents have more value than your metaphor gives them credit for. I mean, realistically, you know, 99% of what you read in the newspaper or hear on the radio in news programs does not fundamentally upend your understanding of the world. It's incremental. And so the idea that this data dump has to somehow expose unsuspected perfidy in high places or completely confound your understanding of how the world works is, to me, a kind of ridiculous standard. I think this stuff is absolutely fascinating. And, you know, reading these stories is a kind of like a graduate seminar in how we relate to Russia, how the Arab world relates to Iran, and so on.
What were the internal deliberations about how to go about combing through the information and what was appropriate to report and what was not?
Well, we had Andy Laren, who's one of our computer reporting guys, spent 14, 16-hour days doing searches, pulling together cables that had similar themes, similar characters, and then reporters read them and did their own supplementary searches of the database. You know, it was a familiar but quite complicated exercise in journalistic choreography. The more sensitive judgments of, you know, how do you deal with cables that might have information that could put lives at risk or somehow compromise national security? That was the subject of lots and lots and lots of conversations. Some stuff was obvious. You know, there were people who, if you put their name in the newspaper as somebody who's talking to the American embassy, they were going to be in real trouble, maybe in jail or killed. And those just come out right off the bat. And then there are the sort of instances where you know that somebody's going to be embarrassed by it, but nothing fundamental is going to be harmed by publishing it. And those are sort of easy to include in. And then there are things that fall in the middle. For example, cables that tell you where unguarded fissile material is located. Even if you think everybody sort of knows it, it's probably not a good thing to put in the newspaper.
On the subject of embarrassing people, the one story, the one revelation that has most gotten my attention is about the relationship between China and North Korea and the cable from a South Korean diplomat, which suggests that China would be just fine with a single unified Korea under South Korean control, so long as no U.S. troops were in the former demilitarized zone. You know, when you're talking about a cornered rat regime such as North Korea's, with the history of acting out when it's in a situation like this, you know, my thought was, could this revelation not just embarrass them, but really trigger something catastrophic? Did it come up? Did you have those discussions?
We did have those kinds of discussions. And, you know, that's where the value of having journalists who've covered these stories over the years supply some context, try to truth test, is useful. Rather than just having raw data sitting out in a website for people to come explore, as we presented it, this is the view of a South Korean diplomat. They believed that if North Korea collapsed and the Koreas reunited, China could live with that, which is interesting, but I don't think particularly provocative. I mean, you know, without any provocation from us or WikiLeaks, North Korea apparently fired on a South Korean ship and more recently lobbed artillery onto a South Korean island. So, you know, what the North Koreans are likely to do or exactly what provokes them is really kind of beyond my understanding.
In the United States, we have seen things like the willy-nilly classification of documents and the invocation of national security at every turn to cover up political embarrassment or worse. But diplomacy is another matter altogether. Is it ever just plain inappropriate for a newspaper to disclose diplomatic secrets?
Look, I absolutely believe that governments have an obligation to keep certain things secret, you know, not just diplomacy, military operations, the codes to the nuclear weapons. I mean, there are lots of things that governments have the right to keep secret. It's their job to keep it secret. It's not the press's job to do that. And when they, for one reason or another, fail to do that, either through something like WikiLeaks or because everybody at the White House is blabbing to Bob Woodward, you know, then we have a choice to make about what we do with those secrets. We do sometimes withhold them, but, you know, it's a choice you have to make case by case.
So this time around, the Times was privy to the documents, but not under any embargo with WikiLeaks. You were
That's
cut
correct.
Out of the deal this time. But in the past, you have worked with the organization in what I believe you've described more as a reporter-source relationship, and you've rejected entirely the idea that it is any kind of partnership. But in doing business with Julian Assange, who is nearly indiscriminate in what he will post, does the Times and the Guardian and Der Spiegel and El País, do they become enablers of an organization that may or may not be itself neutral in going about doing what it's doing?
I don't think so, except in the sense that anytime you publish information from a source, you're giving them, you know, a megaphone, I guess. But I do sincerely believe that the relationship is very much the traditional one of source and journalist. He supplied a lot of raw material, and except for the timing of the release, which was something that we worked out as much with the other news organizations as with WikiLeaks, there was no discussion of what we would write, no discussion of an agenda that we were trying to serve. And in fact, judging by some of the things that Mr. Assange has said about the New York Times, he certainly doesn't regard us as an institution that shares his agenda.
Bill, thank you, as always, for joining us.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Bill Keller is the executive editor of the New York Times.
Coming up, WikiLeaks opens a window in the Middle East. Will it close a window for government whistleblowers?
This is On the Media.
Good work, Jam On. Another world is safe for freedom, justice, and the galactic funk.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Of the many classified diplomatic cables released by WikiLeaks, those quoting Arab leaders talking frankly about Iran were somehow the least surprising and the most titillating. The public statements of Arab governments are often in stark contrast with their private negotiations, lest the leaders be seen by their people as insufficiently Islamic, or worse, as siding with the West or Israel. And so, to hear King Abdullah of Saudi Arabia urging the United States to, quote, cut off the head of the snake in Iran was, well, remarkable. Officials in Bahrain, Abu Dhabi, and elsewhere in the region were similarly blunt in their concerns over Iran and its nuclear ambitions and what to do about them. And then there were the cables about corruption in Afghanistan, state support of terrorism in Saudi Arabia, and state support of Hezbollah in Syria. All previously known or suspected, and yet all fascinating to see discussed so candidly in diplomatic circles. George Washington University political science professor Mark Lynch blogs about the Middle East for Foreign Policy magazine and follows media throughout the region. He says that compared to their Western counterparts, Arab media outlets were a bit slow to report on the leaks, but that they're quickly making up for lost time.
Now they're starting to find their way into the local papers. So the Egyptian independent newspaper Al-Masri Al-Yom and the Lebanese independent newspaper Al-Akhbar have now begun publishing their own little caches that they apparently have been given of specifically Middle East-focused documents. Some of the reports that we're starting to see from Lebanon could be politically explosive as they shed some light on the special tribunal, which is investigating the assassination of former Prime Minister Hariri. There's some Egyptian cables that are showing Egypt's role in the blockade of Gaza, which could prove quite embarrassing. In Kuwait, there's already been a big controversy about a cable about the Guantanamo detainees. There was a front page article in one of the Kuwaiti newspapers with the title, "The Wife Spills the Secrets of the Husband."
The wife disclosing secrets of the husband? What's the reference?
Well, the United States is the wife in this scenario. And this has been all the talk in Kuwaiti society. It's very difficult to predict which things are going to really have that kind of impact. But I think it is fair to say that the regimes are trying to put in place defensive mechanisms. This is a big test of the internet and of social media, because we're seeing the documents and analysis of the documents all over places like Facebook, Twitter, online news sites. And there's always been a big question of whether information and opinion on these websites and on social media can break out into the mass public as opposed to this relatively small number of wired, plugged-in elite youth.
In terms of governments threatened by these revelations, it seems to me that the Gulf states are, like, right at the top of the list. The Saudis have been particularly embarrassed because of cables concerning the funding of terrorists and the kind of double game that the kingdom is playing. How is that being reported in Saudi Arabia and elsewhere?
Well, the Gulf states are particularly threatened because of those revelations, and also because they generally maintain tighter control over the media than in countries like Egypt or Lebanon, which, for all their flaws, have a pretty open and contentious press as it is. The flip side of that is that these governments have a lot of resources to fight back with. For example, the fact that the Saudis control and own major television stations, major newspapers, means they have powerful mouthpieces to fight back against criticism. So, for example, in a Saudi newspaper today, there's an editorial suggesting that some of the websites and newspapers are fabricating cables, or they're mistranslating quotes from the cables, so trying to discredit them in advance.
I want to ask you about the beheading the snake comment from Saudi's King Abdullah. This has gotten a lot of coverage, and so has the general issue of Arab leaders' desire for Iran to be neutralized, especially its nuclear program, but their absolute unwillingness to do it themselves, their wish that Israel or the U.S. does the dirty work for them. How is this revelation being covered?
You're getting some denials of specific phrasings or the like, but you have to remember that the hostility towards Iran in the Gulf is not a secret. This has been a staple of Saudi propaganda and the Saudi media for years. The real issue is that even though they talk tough about this in public or in private, they're not willing to do what they say.
You, in one of your posts, wrote, I think, you know, most provocatively about the wishful thinking that sometimes surrounds the back channel private thoughts of Arab leaders. We come to assume that the real policy is hidden there, whereas their public statements can be safely ignored. But you argue that rather the opposite is true.
Right, because the public statements have the politics factored in already. That represents what these leaders think they can get away with and what they think is going to sell with the audiences they care about. So the conversations you get in private, those are more likely to be what they feel in their hearts, but it's not necessarily a reliable guide to what they're actually going to do. And you read through the cables and you see leaders say one thing, but then when pressed to deliver in public, they say, it's too dangerous, I'd never get away with it. And in the comments by embassy officials, you often see this frustration of the Saudis want to fight Iran to the last dead American. Or the Emiratis talk a big game, but once again, they're failing to deliver. You hear something in private, you think that that means that they're going to do what they say, and then they don't do it. And at this point, we really shouldn't be surprised by it.
All right, Mark. Thanks so much.
Well, thank you very much.
Mark Lynch is a professor of political science at George Washington University. He blogs about the Middle East for Foreign Policy magazine.
WikiLeaks is most commonly referred to as a whistleblower site, But Tom Devine begs to differ. He's the legal director of the Government Accountability Project, the nation's largest whistleblower advocacy organization, and he's been working for 31 years for legislation to protect federal whistleblowers. He was getting darn close until this week, when WikiLeaks, with its uncontrolled revelations, sullied the very word whistleblower in the halls of Congress and threatened to scuttle his hopes and dreams. Devine says that since 1994, only 3 out of 210 cases of whistleblowers appealing their punishments have been successful, because whistleblowers can appeal only in a special whistleblower court, which interprets the law in a way that all but guarantees their appeals will fail.
It's kind of an Orwellian dictionary that they issue their decisions through. For example, the law says that you are eligible for protection if you make any lawful disclosure of significant misconduct. Well, this court has said that any lawful disclosure does not include disclosures to your coworkers, to your supervisor, anything connected with your job duty, which is supposed to be the point of the law, anything involving government policy, even if it's illegal or institutionalizing fraud, waste, and abuse. And that's not the worst. The most recent decision was it doesn't cover any disclosure if you're not the first person to have pointed out that wrongdoing. So much for free speech rights for supporting whistleblowers. What's left is like driving down a road where there's more potholes than pavements.
You were talking about Orwellian language. One word that you encountered trying to protect whistleblowers is irrefragable.
The court said that you don't have a reasonable belief you're disclosing evidence unless you present irrefragable proof. Now, I didn't know what that word meant, but, you know, we're investigators. We tracked it down to Webster's Fourth New Collegiate. And the definition of irrefragable is undeniable, uncontestable, incontrovertible, or incapable of being overthrown. In other words, it leaves beyond a reasonable doubt in the dust. It's far easier to put somebody in jail for being a criminal than for a whistleblower to receive official free speech rights. And that's why they have a 3-in-210 track record.
So tell me, what do these whistleblowers usually blow the whistle about? Can you give me the stories of a couple of your clients?
Well, it runs the gamut. One good example involves Robert McLean. He basically prevented us being completely vulnerable to a more ambitious plan to rerun 9/11 2 years later. The Air Marshals was going to cancel all of its coverage of the airplanes in the middle of it because they'd blown their budget on some corrupt contracts. Mr. McLean challenged it. The Air Marshals blinked, and the planes remained covered, and the hijacking was prevented. And he was fired for breaching security and endangering our country. Another example, Franz Geil, the science advisor for the Marines, and he blew the whistle on their failure to deliver mine-resistant armored vehicles that would actually work against landmines in Iraq, and were responsible for about a third of our combat casualties because the Marines had failed to deliver these armored-resistant vehicles. It would have competed and undermined other contractors who wanted that work. Mr. Guile succeeded. We got, they're called MRAPs, delivered. The unnecessary fatalities stopped. But he was put under 2-year criminal investigation and had a security clearance yanked. Another example is a fellow named George Saris. He was a mechanic out in Kansas. Blew the whistle on not doing basic maintenance on our intelligence aircraft for up to 30 years in some instances. He, again, made a difference. He got the maintenance updated. But when he went to the IG to start that process, they said, well, you've got to have some more evidence for us before we're going to act on this. He gave them the evidence. They then accused him of criminal theft of the evidence that they had demanded. And on that basis, he had a security clearance yanked and doesn't have any duties anymore.
How often are whistleblowers who try to blow the whistle on waste, fraud, and corruption, the ones that you've dealt with, how often are they wrong?
We always do verification studies, always before we represent people. We have to believe in them. The only thing we've got going for us at Gap is credibility. We find that about a third of the cases, the dissent is well taken. About a third of the cases, there's been some injustice, but it's not about things covered by the whistleblower law. It might be racial discrimination or sexual discrimination, mm-hmm. but it's not about betraying the public. And then about a third of the cases, we think the people are phonies.
So tell me about this new bill. You have some real optimism that it might actually be signed into law. The White House described it as landmark legislation. How so? What's new here?
Finally, it ends the monopoly of this one appeals court that's just been rabid and gives the whistleblowers normal access to appeals courts. That's the real significant breakthrough here. The law also expands free speech rights in areas where they didn't currently exist, such as climate change scientists or FDA scientists, 40,000 TSA baggage screeners at the airports, intelligence community employees at the CIA and the NSA who haven't had any free speech rights. They'll have free speech rights now also.
Really? It strikes me that the higher your clearance, the more sensitive the information, the fewer rights you're going to have.
Well, that's absolutely correct. Their free speech rights aren't going to be equivalent to those of an employee at HHS, for example. But unlike current law, they won't be able to be fired for dissenting within the CIA or the NSA. They'll have free speech rights within the workplace. They'll have the freedom to communicate their concerns to Congress. They will have a hearing that's independent of the agencies where they work. And that gets you out of the sort of kangaroo court mode.
Now, you've been gambling that the WikiLeaks story could work on your behalf.
The jury's out. It's easier to take cheap shots at whistleblowers because WikiLeaks has been simplistically given the same kind of label. But WikiLeaks is the opposite approach for someone who witnesses fraud, waste, and abuse. Almost all people who work for the government and see something wrong try to work within the system. If they can't work within their agencies, they try to go to Congress. If that won't work, then they try to go to the media. And very seldom is this anonymous. But right now, every one of those outlets is inviting retaliation against which you can't defend yourself. The only thing that's left is WikiLeaks. If Congress acts rationally, they will provide an alternative to anonymously dumping documents. We hope that the politicians will have enough common sense to take an action that prevents WikiLeaks from becoming a regular pattern in our society. We also hope the politicians are going to play it straight with all the voters fed up with fraud, waste, and abuse by government bureaucracies. If they're serious about it, they'll provide some credible rights to the people on the front lines who risk their careers to honor the same values that the politicians just use in campaign speeches. And any elected leader who doesn't support this legislation or who tries to block it is exposing him or herself as a fraud.
Tom, thank you very much.
Thanks for being interested.
Tom Devine is the legal director of the Government Accountability Project.
And now an update. Earlier this year, we reported on a Washington, D.C. law firm called Dunlap, Grubb & Weaver that had joined with other lawyers to form the U.S. Copyright Group, an organization dedicated to bringing pain to anyone caught downloading movies illegally. The USCG's business model is simple. If you download a movie illegally, they track you down and bust you. You can immediately settle with the group for $1,500, money that's split between the lawyers and the movie companies they represent. The group has even set up a website so you can pay quickly via credit card. Or they will sue you to the tune of $150,000. Nate Anderson of the website Ars Technica spoke to us in June about the U.S. Copyright Group.
There's two real concerns with the approach. One is the amount of money involved here. I think it's debatable whether being hit out of the blue with a demand to pay $1,500 for maybe one film you downloaded, or you could face a $150,000 penalty, you know, it's really a proportional response to what happened. The other question is whether everyone is in fact guilty. And it's clear that that's not the case. So then the question is, how many people were innocent and how many of them just decided to settle rather than dig up a lawyer, pay several thousand dollars just to try to prove their innocence.
The U.S. Copyright Group has sued more than 16,000 people, nearly as many individuals this year alone, as the Recording Industry Association of America did in its entire campaign. But then the Copyright Group hit a few bumps in the road. In September, a loose-knit collective of internet pranksters called Anonymous launched Operation Payback, a series of denial-of-service attacks on the Copyright Group, which took its website down for a number of days. In October, the firm was evacuated after a bomb threat called to its offices. In November, a D.C. court judge ruled that the U.S. Copyright Group cannot file lawsuits against John Doe's that are outside the court's jurisdiction, which happens to be limited to the District of Columbia. And perhaps the cruelest cut of all, a Massachusetts man named Dmitry Shorakov is attempting to file a class-action lawsuit against U.S. Copyright Group, alleging fraud and extortion. He claims the firm has no interest in actually suing people, merely in scaring them to settle. But even if he defeats the USCG, several copycat law firms have already popped up to replace it. The latest specialization in this burgeoning mini-industry? Pursuing illegal downloaders of porn movies. Now we know the wages of sin, roughly $1,500.
Coming up, American wars have always spawned historic First Amendment lawsuits, except for our current wars. Why?
This is On the Media.
Support for On the Media comes from Constant Contact, offering tools to manage, monitor, and measure social media. Learn more at constantcontact.com/social media. The George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, a source for what works in education. Learn more at edutopia.org. And the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Throughout American history, a constant battle has been waged between citizens claiming the right to protest and government officials who would restrict that speech, especially in time of war. At the center stands the Supreme Court, which has rendered some of its most important First Amendment decisions as the nation fought on foreign shores. During World War I, the court upheld the Espionage Act, which criminalized anti-war speech because such speech hindered military recruitment and gave support to our enemies. It upheld the World War II-era Smith Act, which prohibited speech that advocated overthrowing the U.S. government, and it upheld the prohibition on burning your draft card challenged during the Vietnam War. Obviously, these cases were not decided in ways that would please free speech advocates, but at least they were heard. Slate senior editor Dahlia Lithwick recently noted the curious absence of free speech protest cases during the current wars.
You see a lot fewer protests happening where someone stands on a soapbox and they're surrounded by other people and they hurl anti-government epithets. And to the extent that they happen, I think that those are not worrisome to the government. But I think the government's been better able to monitor anti-war sentiment through the Patriot Act and through FISA. If you're spying on people in secret, you don't need to go out to the city square and put cuffs on them. And also there's a sense that protest in itself isn't the problem. I think you're seeing a real shift in what the government perceives to be domestic aiding and abetting of the enemy.
Which brings us to Holder versus Humanitarian Law Project. This is perhaps the single most significant decision that is related to speech and the war on terrorism. But it wasn't about protest at all.
This is a case about the Patriot Act, which makes it illegal to give, quote, material aid to terror groups. And material aid is defined so broadly that it criminalizes certain forms of speech. And so things as simple as telling a terrorist group how they might procure humanitarian aid or how they might engage in non-terror-related activities like alternative dispute resolution. And the question for the people who object to the statute is, wait. What we're doing is we're telling Hamas how to dig wells. We're telling them how to get humanitarian aid. In other words, we're trying to help them not be terrorist groups. How can that possibly be providing material aid to terror groups? I spoke to Erwin Chemerinsky, who's the dean of UC Irvine law school. And he said that this is really a very, very dramatic provision that was upheld because it punishes speech merely advising how to use international law without any showing that it leads to harm in and of itself. So he feels like it's a very, very expansive definition of what is impermissible speech and that it's quite different. And I think one other thing that's worth thinking about from the conversation you and I are having, one would think the Supreme Court wasn't granting speech cases at all. That's not the case. This happens to be a sizzling moment for First Amendment doctrine at the Supreme Court. If you look at the cases that the court is really interested in, not only do they have nothing to do with war protest, they have everything to do with entertainment. And so you have a major Supreme Court case about the constitutionality of criminalizing crush videos. Do you know about those?
An animal is crushed to death under a stiletto heel?
Yes, as a woman whispers weird sexual enticements to it. So the Supreme Court hears that case last year. They hear Citizens United last year, which
gave corporations the same right of free speech as individuals, thereby allowing them to contribute unrestricted amounts of money to political campaigns.
But it also starts out as a conflict over a long attack ad on Hillary Clinton.
Mm-hmm.
So this is about a movie, first and foremost. This term, that big Supreme Court First Amendment case, is going to be about banning violent video games. The other big, big case this year is Snyder v. Phelps, and this is the Fred Phelps Westboro Baptist Church. They go around to these military funerals and hold up incredibly offensive signs that say, "Thank God for dead soldiers and God hates fags," trying to say that the reason soldiers are dying overseas is because America tolerates homosexuality. So if you lump it together with the other cases I'm talking about, the Supreme Court is very, very interested in the boundaries of angry attacking speech, not all that interested in wartime protest speech. I think the court is very, very split on these issues of civility. A lot of the justices seem to feel that the internet changes everything. And Justice Stephen Breyer, one of the most liberal justices on the court, is really, I think, spearheading this movement that says the internet makes inflammatory speech much more pernicious and dangerous, so maybe we need to clamp down. So it's a very, very interesting moment, reflective of the court just really grappling with what video and video games, how all that is going to interact with centuries-old free speech doctrine. But as I said, if you just look at it in a vacuum, you would never know there was a war going on as well.
Dahlia, thank you so much.
Oh, you're so welcome, Brooke.
Dahlia Lithwick is the senior editor of Slate. Supreme Court Justice William J. Brennan once said, "Law cannot stand aside from the social changes around it." Brennan served on the court from 1956 to 1990, a time of extraordinary social upheaval in America, and during that time, he helped forge the modern interpretation of the First Amendment that we now take for granted. But his personal opinions didn't always line up comfortably with his legal ones. Seth Stern is a reporter for Congressional Quarterly and co-author of the new biography titled Justice Brennan, Liberal Champion. Seth, welcome to On the Media.
Thanks so much for having me.
So could you begin in 1964 with one of Brennan's earliest and most famous decisions, New York Times versus Sullivan?
Sure. The case actually goes back to March 1960. An ad appeared in the New York Times soliciting contributions for a committee to defend Martin Luther King and the civil rights movement. And the ad condemned violence directed at civil rights demonstrators. It didn't refer to any Southerners by name, but L.B. Sullivan, a Montgomery, Alabama city commissioner, filed suit against the Times and four of the clergymen who had signed the ad, claiming the ad's references to Alabama had defamed him. Now, the ad contained some minor errors, such as suggesting students had sung My Country Tis of Thee rather than the Star-Spangled Banner, which they had actually sang, and an Alabama jury awarded Sullivan $500,000. Several other local officials in Alabama filed suit, and the Times soon faced millions of dollars in potential damages. Now, the goal for those filing suit was to drive the Times and other news organizations out of the South. And the idea was if they could force the reporters out, the news coverage and the sympathy might dry up.
Seth, you're going to have to explain to me what the significance of mixing up the Star-Spangled Banner and My Country Tis of Thee is to the charge of libel leveled by Sullivan.
the state of libel law in that era was that any error was an error, and you could recover for those errors if the defendant couldn't prove the truth of the statement at issue. And so it was almost a trap. And in news coverage, there's inevitably inadvertent errors.
So how was Brennan's decision important to our understanding of a free press?
Well, up to that point, libel law had really been weighted heavily in favor of those filing suit. Brennan basically put the burden on a plaintiff to prove that a defendant had knowingly or recklessly published a falsehood. The term of art that he used was actual malice, and he actually came to have some regret, some buyer's remorse about using that term, as he told my co-author. He came to view it as too confusing for jurors who came to associate this notion of actual malice with the idea of hatred or ill will, and that really wasn't what was meant by the term actual malice.
You've said that Chief Justice Earl Warren asked Brennan to write the Sullivan opinion because, at least in part, Brennan had carved out a niche in the areas of free expression and obscenity.
His very first term on the Supreme Court, a case came up. Someone was accused of violating the federal statute barring the mailing of obscene materials. His name was Samuel Roth, and Chief Justice Warren, who was very famously prudish and uncomfortable with obscenity, assigned the case to Brennan. It was an unusually high-profile assignment for a freshman justice. And Brennan himself was pretty uneasy with obscenity, but he wound up writing an opinion that helped liberalize obscenity law.
Out of it emerged the so-called Roth test. Could you describe that?
Well, he defined obscenity as whether to an average person, applying contemporary community standards, the dominant theme appeals to the prurient interest. This was a deviation from the prevailing standard. It was according to the average person, not the most sensitive person who might be easily offended. It was whether the dominant theme of the work was obscene, rather than just a choice excerpt. In the past, you could have a very brief passage in a book and an entire work might be deemed obscene. Very quickly, it would prove to be the vehicle for liberalizing obscenity law.
He came to the conclusion ultimately that obscenity ought to be protected unless it's distributed to minors.
Yes, the court ultimately went in that direction. They basically got themselves out of the business of trying to determine whether individual works were obscene or not. There was a point in the 60s and 70s, famously recounted in The Brethren, the Bob Woodward account of the Supreme Court in 1979, where the justices would gather in a basement room and watch obscene movies along with their clerks. It was very distasteful to all of them, and I think they were quite happy to get out of that sort of micromanagement of obscenity.
Much later in his career, flag burning came before the court. Can you tell us what Brennan had to say about speaking with fire?
In 1984, Gregory Johnson had burned a flag outside Dallas City Hall during the Republican National Convention that was held there. He was convicted under a Texas law, and the case reached the Supreme Court in 1989. By that point, Brennan had been in the court for 33 years, and he wrote a majority opinion ruling that expression can't be prohibited simply because it's offensive. And that decision prompted a furious backlash. Flags were mailed to him of every shape and size. A neighbor in his condo building hung a flag on the door so that every time he got off the elevator, he couldn't miss it. The president signed into law quickly a federal flag-burning law, but Brennan was really unbowed, and a year later he wrote a 5-4 decision striking down that Flag Protection Act.
Now, I mentioned in the introduction that Brennan's legal opinions sometimes were in conflict with his personal opinions or even his behavior. He was a champion of speech in the press, and yet he rarely, if ever, gave interviews and was generally distrustful of reporters.
Absolutely. Reporters drove him crazy. And yet he really believed that unpopular and sometimes offensive speech is the price that we have to pay to have free speech and to have robust public debate.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Seth Stern is a reporter for Congressional Quarterly and co-author with Stephen Wermiel of Justice Brennan, Liberal Champion.
Google has changed the world by instantly, reliably delivering relevant and helpful search results. Because page rankings are determined in part by how many users link to a given page, placing high in a search result seems like a de facto endorsement from the internet at large. But what if you could move yourself up in Google rankings by being most disliked? New York Times reporter David Siegel wrote a story last Friday about a woman named Clarabel Rodriguez who purchased contact lenses and some designer eyeglasses from the online store DecorMyEyes.com. When the package arrived, according to Rodriguez, among other problems, the eyeglasses were counterfeits. That's when she contacted Vitali Borker, the man behind Decor My Eyes. And according to Siegel, things quickly got out of hand.
And when she made it clear to Vitali, who always poses as one of his alter egos, in this case, a man named Tony Rousseau, that she wanted to return them and that she would contest this charge on her credit card, he just erupted. And that was the beginning of about 2 months of very, very unpleasant email and phone harassment. The day that the credit card company finished its investigation, someone posing as Clarabel Rodriguez called in and said, "I dropped this contest." So Clarabel was contacted by Citibank, who said, "Well, we're glad that you've dropped your contesting of these charges and your credit card has been billed again." She just flat out said, "Look, you've been hoodwinked. Someone posing as me has called." Citibank completely stonewalled her. I mean, they flatly refused to even entertain that complaint.
Now, Clarabel Rodriguez dealt not only with Borker and with Citibank, she took her complaints elsewhere as well, did she not?
She figured out a little too late that Vitali slash Tony Rousseau had been complained about endlessly on a bunch of consumer websites, including one called GetSatisfaction.com. She also posted a thing on that website that said, "I'm going to try to build a case against him, and anyone who's had interactions with him should write to me, and we'll bring it to this detective who is looking into the case." That further incensed Vitali and drove him to new heights of nastiness.
Okay, so naturally you contact Vitali Borker.
I called him because he had posted something on Get Satisfaction and said, "All of the complaining that you do helps my Google ranking."
From what little anybody knows about the Google algorithm, it's based on the number of links to your pages. And if lots of people link to them, that pushes your ranking up.
And he was kind of weirdly delighted to share what he thought was this interesting business model because Google couldn't tell the difference between withering critiques and adulatory buzz. He felt like he had discovered some remarkable new strategy to succeed in web commerce. He basically spends all of his days in a lather, either selling glasses or screaming at people who've bought from him and are trying to return them.
I can sort of see how being a bore moved his page rank up, but has he no fear of how these other businesses on which he depends, his web hosting company, his internet service provider, might react to his shenanigans?
It was next to impossible for Clarabel to get any traction with any of the complaints that she made. MasterCard does not inspire a lot of fear in Vitali Borker because it turns out that he got bounced from their system last year and he just changed something about his identity and got back on. More than anything, it was just a lesson in how futile life is for a consumer who just has a phone and doesn't have a newspaper standing behind her or him to help out.
But as it turned out, Clarabel Rodriguez did have a newspaper. And as a consequence of your story, a number of things have happened. Maybe most amazingly, Google has made fixes that it says will mitigate the problems created by characters like Vitali Borker. That's quite a feather in your cap.
I'll say. I think it's the first time anything has changed as a result of anything that I've written.
You know, as I saw your story, I wondered to myself if there's actually a bona fide business model in making a jerk of yourself in order to move up in page rankings, or whether this is an outlier.
I think he is an outlier. I think he is an extreme case. I write a column every other week for the Sunday Business section where people write to me and complain about things, and I try to call the company that has wronged them and rectify the situation. And mostly it's just companies that are ignoring people. They're not out to terrify them.
Some of this is about the quirks of the Google algorithm, but some of it also has to do with the people's habits when using search engines and their seeming reluctance not just click on something and do business there because they're at the top of the list, but to drill at least a couple of levels deeper to find out what's what.
anytime you buy anything on the web, just type the name of the company and the word complaint into a Google search, and you will learn everything you need to know.
I'm typing in David Siegel, New York Times, complaint. Let's see what we can come up with. Oh.
There's a violin maker by that name. I'm sure it's about him.
David, thanks so much.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
David Siegel is a reporter for the New York Times. That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Jamie York, Mike Vuolo, Nazanin Rafsanjani, Alex Goldman, PJ Vogt, and Brett Jaspers, with more help from Nerida Brownlee, and it was edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineers this week were John DeLure and Dylan Keefe.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer. Ellen Horn is WNYC's senior director of national programs. And the cream in our coffee, bassist composer Ben Allison, wrote our theme. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
Since WNYC's first broadcast in 1924, we've been dedicated to creating the kind of content we know the world needs. Since then, New York Public Radio's rigorous journalism has gone on to win a Peabody Award and a DuPont Columbia Award, among others. In addition to this award-winning reporting, your sponsorship also supports inspiring storytelling and extraordinary music that is free and accessible to all. To get in touch and find out more, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.